People in the southwestern Iranian city of Izeh hold a funeral for victims of Wednesday's terror attack. The U.S. military says one of its bases in northeast Syria has come under a rocket attack. And Russia accuses the U.S. of testing the patience of North Korea as tensions simmer on the Korean Peninsula. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. People in the southwestern Iranian city of Izeh have held a funeral for victims of the Wednesday terror attack. Mourners express their grief for the victims, while at the same time slamming those behind the deadly assault. Two gunmen shot at people in the central Izeh, Khuzestan province. Seven people, including a child, lost their lives. As a result, 10 more were also injured. Also, last month, a terror attack took place at a revered shrine in Iran's southern city of Shiraz, leaving over a dozen people dead. The assaults came on the heels of recent riots in Iran. Iran says terrorists have taken advantage of the wave of unrest and rioting, which were hatched and staged by foreign-backed elements. Iran's vice president for economic affairs, Mohsen Rezai, attended the funeral in Izeh. He said this country will take revenge against all those behind the terror attack there. Rezai made the comments as he addressed people taking part in the funeral procession. He said the terrorists involved in the attack in Izeh were arrested while they were trying to flee Iran via the northwestern borders. Rezai also said that the United States is attempting to foment insecurity in Iran. Those attempts, he added, are in line with America's policy to exert pressure on Iran through imposing sanctions. The Iranian officials said that the U.S. is resorting to creating unrest in Iran because Tehran has already managed to mitigate the effects of the sanctions. University professor Mohammad Marandi says foreign governments have used their agents inside Iran to ruthlessly murder innocent people, but to blame the Iranian government.
Over the last 2-3 days, we've seen an upsurge in the number of police officers and Basij members massacred by these thugs in Esfahan, in Mashhad, in Bukhan, and of course in Izeh. Now, what is unique about Izeh is that now these thugs that have murdered these innocent people and injured police officers, they are, alongside the Persian media based in London and Western countries, trying to blame the government for these murders. And it's clear who benefits from these acts. It's obvious which countries benefit from the death of innocent people in Iran. So we have to make, I think the government has to start changing its policy. And those governments that are behind this, those Western governments and those regional governments that are behind this, have to pay a heavy price. This is the continuation of these policies where the police are left vulnerable, the Basij are left vulnerable, is unacceptable.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman has condemned the U.S. sanctions on the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting officials and reporters. Nasser Kanani says this is another example of the blatant violation of Iranians' rights by the U.S. Kanani says the U.S. is preventing the views of Iranian people from being heard around the world. He says that this is while it allows various, quote, terrorist networks and media to comment malicious acts against Iran. According to the Iranian official, this shows that the U.S. has no plans to end its crimes against independent countries. The U.S. sanctions target the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting as well as its deputy for World Services, which also doubles as Press TV chief. The European Union and Canada have also imposed sanctions on Press TV. The bans are part of wider sanctions targeting Iranian officials and entities over alleged human rights violations following recent riots in Iran. Tehran has strongly rejected those claims and slammed the bans as a clear example of meddling in the country's internal affairs. Journalist and political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas says Press TV is on the target because it counters fake news spread by the West propaganda machine.
Soft power war, which the Americans and their partners have engaged in, is equally as powerful as the hard power of military intervention. In fact, I would go as far as to say that the soft power war is far more effective and powerful a tool in their eyes, and they continue to demand that kind of support. For that division. I mean, and then the response of Press TV obviously gives them a huge problem. It's a huge problem for them that the Press TV truth counters the fake news that they invariably put out. So they terrorize nations through propaganda, through fake news, through false information, through entire campaigns. The Russians are victims of it at the moment. The Iranians have been for many, many years. But I think the Iranians have to stay steadfast. They have to take confidence and talk this up as another victory, really, because if they're that scared of Press TV, which they've limited in so many ways as it is, and are censoring it on virtually every platform that one knows here in the West, and yet they're still so terrified of it that they need to sanction it even more, then that, I think, in itself tells the story.
The U.S. military says one of its bases in northeast Syria has come under a rocket attack. The U.S. military says rockets targeted the Green Village base, which is close to Iraq's border with Syria, late on Thursday. The military says no damage or casualties were caused. It also says American forces are investigating the incident. Attacks on U.S. military bases in the region, mainly in Iraq, have increased over the past several years as anti-American sentiments run high. Those sentiments began to rise after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in January 2020. He was a key anti-terror figure. South Korea says the neighboring North has made its second weapons launch in 2 days, firing a suspected intercontinental ballistic missile towards the Sea of Japan. According to the South Korean military, the latest missile flew 1,000 kilometers and reached an altitude of almost 6,100. On Thursday, North Korea tested a short-range ballistic missile as well. The National Security Council in Seoul has already met to discuss the latest developments. Japan has also confirmed the latest launch, saying that the missile fell in waters in its exclusive economic zone. Tokyo says it was an ICBM that had enough range to reach U.S. mainland. China has also reacted to the launch, calling for dialogue.
China pays close attention to the development of the current situation on the Korean Peninsula. Maintaining peace and stability on the peninsula and preventing the situation from deteriorating and escalating conform to the common interests of the international community. We hope that all parties concerned will stick to the direction of political settlement and resolve the respective concerns in a balanced way through meaningful dialogue.
The U.S. has strongly condemned North Korea's missile test, calling it a brazen violation of U.N. Security Council resolutions. Russia, in the meantime, has accused the U.S. of testing North Korea's patience. Moscow says it is evident that Washington and its allies in the region prefer a path different from diplomatic approach. Pyongyang has fired a barrage of missiles in recent months in response to what it describes as U.S. hostilities. It is strongly critical of joint military drills frequently held by Washington and Seoul, saying that they are a rehearsal for an invasion. Our correspondent Jennifer Chang in Seoul explains why North Korea has conducted its latest test and what it means for the U.S.
This test came after a regional gathering in Cambodia recently, at which the U.S. President Joe Biden held a summit with the Japanese Prime Minister and the South Korean President and pledged to defend South Korea and Japan with the full range of U.S. military weapons, including nuclear weapons. But if the North holds U.S. cities hostage with a nuclear-tipped ICBM, there's little that the U.S. can do to defend South Korea. This is what many experts are saying. The Hwasong-17, fired successfully today by the North, can carry multiple warheads, including decoys, capable of evading U.S. missile defenses. And the nuclear warhead would just be one of those decoys. It would be one weapon mixed in with those decoys. And it would be impossible to tell which is a decoy and which is a nuclear warhead. So the U.S. would be helpless to defend a U.S. city against a North Korean ICBM tipped with a nuclear warhead.
Soaring prices in Japan have hit the wallets of consumers as the inflation peaks its highest level in nearly four decades. Core consumer prices, excluding fresh food, increased by 3.6% in October compared to a year ago. That is according to data by the Japanese government. High prices of energy and raw material, as well as a weak national currency, are to blame for high inflation. The chief cabinet secretary says that has taken a toll on people's basic needs. Japan's central bank is resisting tilting to tightening monetary policy. It says that there is no need to raise interest rates in a move that some experts believe would help stave off inflation. In recent months, some central banks, like the U.S. Federal Reserve, have raised interest rates to contain inflation. World leaders are in Thailand's capital, Bangkok, to attend the summit of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, known as APEC. Chinese President Xi Jinping and U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris are among the participants at the summit. The two-day gathering discusses sustainable economic growth and trade. The war in Ukraine is on the agenda, too. Thailand has called for putting aside differences and focusing on resolving pressing global economic issues such as inflation. APEC member states consist of over a third of the global population. They make up 62% of gross domestic product and nearly half of global trade. The UK government has unveiled an emergency budget. It includes tens of billions of dollars in spending cuts and tax increases as the government seeks to restore its economic credibility and patch up the nation's battered finances. Saeed Puraza reports.
Transfixed, ordinary Britons stand glued to their screens, waiting for the news to sink in. After weeks of will he not, the UK's new chancellor has announced his economic plan for the country. Except for a couple of surprise rabbits out of the hat, such as a bit of more spending in the health and education sectors, it was what everyone had expected. Tax hikes and spending cuts aimed at plugging a nearly $65 billion hole in public finances created by the previous Conservative government only 2 months ago. Pretty soon, millions of Britons will be paying more taxes. A freeze on the non-taxable part of their income will mean millions will be dragged into higher tax brackets, and the cap on energy bills introduced by the previous government will be scaled back as of April next year. As if that wasn't enough, Britons are going to see public sector spending cuts to the tune of $30 billion. All this as the country grapples with double-digit inflation, rising energy costs, and a prolonged recession, none of which was lost on the opposition.
What does this mean? Family holidays cancelled, savings depleted, hopes for the future replaced by sleepless nights. And all of this on top of the fact that the average worker is earning less today than when the Tories came to power 12 years ago. The government has presided over the biggest wage squeeze in centuries. This was a crisis made in Downing Street, and it is ordinary working people who are paying the price.
As ever, the Chancellor, as did the PM before him, blamed Britain's economic woes on the pandemic and external factors such as the war in Ukraine. But many experts say that's not all.
There are international factors. However, Britain has managed to achieve something on its own for one or two areas, such as the impact of Brexit. Whereas with when they were in the EU, they had access to the world's largest free trade area. Britain deliberately took itself out of that and hasn't been able to replace it with anything. So that's had extra cost to it. And so there's also been less confidence in Britain because it's outside that. Why should I be investing? And so if it's not seen to be as really secure and full of confidence, then investors will go elsewhere. And that's what we've been seeing.
Despite the government saying its measures announced today are necessary for balancing the books, there is no doubt that they will have real consequences for millions of Britons for years to come. Cypher is up, London.
Investigations point to Ukraine's involvement in Tuesday's missile explosion on Poland soil, but Washington and Kiev insist that Moscow is to blame for the deadly incident. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The racist behaviour of the anti-Islamic groups in Germany has angered the Muslim community in that country. Far-right groups in Germany are trying to exploit the current economic and energy crises to instill fear and hatred against minorities, in particular Muslims. But despite the spread of Islamophobia in the West and the rise of far-right groups in the last two decades, conversion to Islam among Europeans has actually increased significantly. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. German authorities registered at least 662 Islamophobic crimes in 2021. There were more than 46 mosques attacked in Germany, and at least 17 people were injured because of anti-Muslim violence. Süleyman Demir, project director at the anti-discrimination group INSAN, said attacks on Muslims and mosques have seen a rise following the coronavirus pandemic, and the situation is serious as Germany is facing economic difficulties. Süleyman Demir added, the statistics have definitely increased, especially for women who wear the headscarf. He said, we're also increasingly seeing from our community that not only men but also women who wear the hijab are exposed to much more physical attacks, and this has actually increased significantly in recent years. German authorities recorded 152 Islamophobic attacks, while at least 7 people were injured in the first 6 months of 2022. But that might not be the full picture, because many of the attacks go unreported. Süleyman Demir, who is leading the Network Against Discrimination and Islamophobia project at INSAN, said many Muslims do not report incidents to the German police, thinking their complaints will not be taken seriously. Demir added, sometimes they don't feel heard or seen, and that's why they think, oh, why report it anyway? There won't be any consequences. He urged better sensitivity training for police officers to tackle Islamophobic crimes. Demir said, police officers are not properly trained. They're not trained on tackling anti-Muslim crimes. Adding that many incidents of Islamophobia are not properly registered by police in crime statistics. Süleyman Demir also warned that far-right groups are trying to exploit the ongoing economic and energy crisis in Germany to stir fear and hatred against minorities, and in particular Muslims. He said, it is easy to portray minorities as scapegoats, that is, as scapegoats for political or economic problems in the country. And the far-right groups naturally use this method to say that these minorities are to be blamed for the major economic crisis in the country. Therefore, I see a connection between the rising right-wing extremism and the economic situation in the country. Demir said it is important for Muslims and minorities to be more politically active to strengthen democracy and counter the rise of the far-right. He said, there are people from 180 to 200 different nations here, so I assume that Muslims will also feel at home here, especially those who were born here. They will take part in democratic decision-making and, of course, will also shape the future of Germany. Meanwhile, the Shia Studies website has also reported on the same story. A survey conducted by researchers from Germany, Netherlands and Britain revealed veiled Muslim women face far more discrimination than others when applying for jobs in these countries. Utrecht University in the Netherlands, Oxford University in England and the German Centre for Integration and Migration Research conducted a joint field survey on the discrimination faced by religious minorities seeking jobs in the three European labour markets, that is, Germany, Netherlands and Spain. The findings of the experiment were shared in an article published by Oxford Academic recently titled Discrimination Unveiled, a field experiment on the barriers faced by Muslim women in Germany, the Netherlands and Spain. The experiment was conducted with the curriculum vitae of the same people by using the same content and information with both veiled and unveiled photographs. As the photographs on curriculum vitae shows whether the person wears a hijab or not, the cross-nationally harmonized experiment aimed to demonstrate to what extent the responses of these people received from employers differ. The results in the Netherlands proved that 35% of women with headscarves got responses from employers, while this rate rose to 70% among those not wearing headscarves. The experiment said a similar scenario in Germany, showing that 25% of the veiled candidates and 53% of the unveiled candidates received responses from employers. The article stressed, Muslims are perceived by the public at large as a difficult to integrate group, mainly due to their high levels of religiosity, which are seemingly at odds with the so-called European values and the secular lifestyles of Western societies. It presented robust evidence that veiled Muslim women are discriminated against in Germany and in the Netherlands, for example, when applying for jobs that require a high level of customer contact. In Germany, even though employers responded to the job application of half of the unveiled Muslim women, they did not give any response to 75% of the Muslim women wearing headscarves. The website of the Middle East Monitor has also covered the same story. A new report has warned Islamophobia remains a growing threat across Europe, with several countries enacting policies that have contributed to the institutionalization of an issue that should instead be stamped out with urgency. According to the European Islamophobia Report 2021, Islamophobia was as pressing a problem across the European continent as it was in previous years. It said countries like Germany, France and Britain became the main spots of anti-Muslim hatred and Islamophobic incidents. The report, which focused on the 27 European countries and was prepared with contributions from 35 leading academics and experts in the field, read, "Furthermore, anti-Muslim campaigns of far-right political parties in the European Union member states dominate the discrimination against Muslim individuals and communities." The report links the persistence of anti-Muslim racism to the backdrop of general worrisome trend, the decline of liberal democracy in Europe. It warns that major forces within Europe, singling out countries like Germany, are still investing less in the fight against Islamophobia and more into normalizing Islamophobia. The report said, "The Islamophobia becoming normalized and institutionalized by the so-called liberal democracies such as Germany and France is alarming." Apart from Islamophobic incidents across Europe, the report details systemic discrimination faced by Muslims in all areas of life, from employment to healthcare to education and to the justice system. Germany has the second largest Muslim community in Western Europe, after France, with total inhabitants of more than 84 million. Among the country's nearly 5.5 million Muslims, 3 million are of Turkish origin.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far. Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence Imam al-Jawad was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him. We find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam economized when it came to spending upon himself. He lived a rather ascetic, simple lifestyle. But His Eminence Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam spent a great abundant amount of wealth on the poor and the needy people amongst the Muslims. And it is precisely because of this unequaled and unparalleled generosity that Imam al-Jawad has been called and titled Al-Jawad, the Generous. This surname was the most particular and famous surname of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, to the extent that he was well known and famous for it amongst the people.
Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam stated, "Exposing something before it has become consolidated will ruin it."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are here together talking about the beautiful dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Jawad alayhi salam. Now, of course, as we have said in previous programs, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam is the son of the eighth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam. Now, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, being known as the son of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, he was well known amongst the Shias. And so we find that he was one of the Imams who was quite young when they attained and received the status, or they were divinely appointed as the Imam of humanity. Now, of course, because of the young age of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, we find that there were many conversations that took place. There were many academic and religious scientific questions posed to the Imam in order to try to test him and prove that he truly is the Imam. Now, of course, this occurred because people saw his young age and they kind of thought that perhaps imamat is a position and a divine appointment that occurs after a certain age. And so within these conversations, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam has these beautiful statements that come forth. So in one such instance, a companion asks him about the concept and the idea of trusting in Allah. And so Imam al-Jawad says to him that the trust in Allah is like a fort which no one takes refuge in except the believers. And the reliance on Allah is a protection from every evil and a refuge from every enemy. So, dear friends, here we see that in this conversation, Imam al-Jawad replies and says that this trust and having trust in the Almighty Allah is a fort. But it is a fort in which only those who are believers, they are mu'mineen, can enter into this fort and take refuge into it. Now, of course, you know, anybody can have the trust of Allah and anybody can have trust in Allah. But truly, the pure form of the trust in Allah is one in which the believers start to attain. And of course, the trust in Allah also has various levels. It has stages. The higher stages are reserved for believers, for true mu'mineen, for the muttaqeen, the pious, and for the awliya of Allah, the saints or the near ones of Allah. And of course, as you keep on going higher in the stages of the trust in Allah, then we reach the levels of, for example, the imams and the divinely appointed prophets as well. But the second statement, which is really interesting, from Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, is where he says that the reliance on Allah is a protection from every evil and a refuge from every enemy. And of course, when we begin to rely upon a power such as the Almighty Allah, who has power over everything, who has command over everything, who is the creation of everything that is in existence, He is the supreme and the almighty and the all-powerful, the all-seeing, the all-hearing, the all-wise, the all-knowing. You know, then, you know, we start to realize that if we rely on the Almighty Allah, who has these attributes that are a part of Allah's essence, then it is that same Allah who will protect us from every kind of evil and will give us refuge and safe haven from every kind of enemy. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid.
Respected brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. When we examine the life of Imam number one, we come to know that his father, Imam Ali bin Musa Ridha, salamullahi alayhi, spent the difficult life when he was kept far away from his son, Imam al-Jawad. To take Imam al-Ridha to that area which today we know as Mashhad, for a father to leave his young son alone in Medina, it was a difficult. But yes, a test was decided to happen, and it happened. Now, when Imam al-Jawad received the news that his father, Imam al-Ridha, has passed away, at that time he was 8 years of age. Today, when you look at a young man of 8, you cannot give many responsibilities to him. But when we come back again to Alamul Amr, Allah has decreed that this will happen and he will become the Imam. And it was a difficult moment for people who used to follow Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam. When they looked at the young Imam after him, you could see that in a normal circumstances as human beings, when you are told that this is your leader, when you look at your leader, there are many qualities you want to know from your leader. One of the qualities is that maturity is important. He can fit to be the leader. It is whether he can fulfill the duties of a leadership or not.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, Fi Amanillah, and God bless you all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt is planning to boost the national living wage in an effort to help Britons through the cost of living crisis. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Sun has more for us. Jeremy Hunt is planning to boost the national living wage in an effort to help Britons through the cost of living crisis. The Chancellor of the Exchequer is preparing a 10% hike, which would see the threshold rise from £9.50 to £10.40 an hour. The move would mean a payday for more than 2.5 million Britons. The national living wage is the minimum amount all employers have to pay staff aged 23 and over. Those younger than 23 years old can be paid the minimum wage instead, which is £9.18 an hour for 21 and 22-year-olds and £6.83 an hour for those aged 18 to 20. Final confirmation of changes to the living wage will come this Thursday, when Jeremy Hunt reveals his autumn statement. The major budget will deal with how the Treasury is going to fill an estimated £50 billion black hole in the public purse. The gaping hole came about because of the coronavirus pandemic, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, soaring energy costs, and Liz Truss's disastrous mini-budget. On Sunday, the Chancellor warned tax rises will hit everyone and that we'll all be paying a bit more tax. Gloomy Jeremy Hunt added that there will be no enticing rabbit out of the hat policies either. But yesterday, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak dropped his biggest hint yet that pensioners will be protected while others feel the squeeze. Asked if he would hike pensions in line with inflation next year, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak insisted he was someone who understands the particular challenge of pensioners, adding that they will always be at the forefront of my mind. However, the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt is set to give councils more power to raise local taxes to pay for social care. Currently, local government chiefs are only allowed to hike it by 2.99% plus a 1% levy for elderly care without a local referendum. But the threshold for such a vote is set to be raised, meaning it is harder to block hikes. Meanwhile, Jeremy Hunt will call time on the £10 billion a month universal energy bill support, with only the least well-off in line for hefty support. Bills for the average British home are said to be capped £500 higher than now at £3,000. Sky News has also covered the same story. Chancellor Jeremy Hunt will announce a rise in the national living wage this week. Jeremy Hunt and Prime Minister Rishi Sunak will accept an official recommendation to increase the living wage from £9.50 an hour to about £10.40 an hour, according to news first reported by The Times. The rise of nearly 10% would benefit around 2.5 million people, according to The Times. Among the other measures reportedly being considered are cost of living payments for 8 million households worth up to £1,100, payments of £650 for those on means-tested benefits such as universal credit, £150 for disability benefit recipients, and £300 for pensioner households. Freezing of thresholds for income tax, national insurance, VAT, inheritance tax, and pension savings. Removing the requirement for local authorities to hold a referendum before increasing council tax by more than 2.99%, allowing them to raise significantly more money. The new threshold could be 5%, according to the Daily Telegraph. The moves are part of plans to cut spending by £33 billion and raise taxes by £22 billion to plug a black hole in Britain's finances. The government has already said the poorest households will be prioritised, leaving wealthy and middle-income households to bear the greatest burden from tax increases. One of the main focuses will be energy cuts, with changes to be made to the price guarantee announced in September by Rishi Sunak's predecessor Liz Truss. The price guarantee meant that a typical household would face energy bills of no more than £2,500 a year, but this could rise to as much as £3,100 from next April, and even this would leave taxpayers with a large bill. There have also been hints that the autumn statement on Thursday could include benefits and pensions being increased in line with inflation, a move that will cost around £11 billion. The triple lock on the state pensions, which guarantees an increase in line with average earnings, inflation, or 2.5%, whichever is higher, was part of the Conservatives' manifesto in 2019. But as inflation soared past 10%, it has become increasingly expensive. Speaking to reporters accompanying him on his trip to the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia, Rishi Sunak said, "My track record as Chancellor shows I care very much about those pensioners, particularly when it comes to things like energy and heating, because they're especially vulnerable to cold weather. That's why when I announced support earlier this year as Chancellor, we made extra provision for pensioners to receive up to £300 alongside their winter fuel payments to help them cope with energy bills over the winter months. So I'm someone who understands the particular challenge of pensioners. They will always be at the forefront of my mind." Website of LBC, lbc.co.uk, has also covered the same story. Pensioners are set to escape brutal spending cuts as Prime Minister Rishi Sunak raises the living wage in a boost for the poorest. Prime Minister Sunak and Chancellor Jeremy Hunt will accept an official recommendation to increase the living wage from £9.50 an hour to around £10.40 an hour, a rise of nearly 10%. 8 million households will also receive cost of living payments worth up to £1,100 as Rishi Sunak introduces targeted support for poorest over universal measures. Those on universal credit could receive £650, disability benefit recipients £150, and pensioner households will receive £300, with some people able to claim all three. However, the energy price guarantee is set to increase from a £2,500 bill for the average home to as much as £3,100 from next April. Treasury sources would neither confirm nor deny speculation ahead of Thursday's autumn statement. It comes after Rishi Sunak hinted at keeping the pension's triple lock, which guarantees an increase in line with average earnings, inflation, or 2.5%, whichever is higher, as he spoke during his trip to the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia. Rishi Sunak said, "My track record as Chancellor shows I care very much about those pensioners, particularly when it comes to things like energy and heating." He declined to comment on any specifics in the financial statement, but stressed that we will put fairness and compassion at the heart of all decisions we make. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and Chancellor Jeremy Hunt are said to be considering allowing local authorities to impose larger rises in council tax next year to raise money for social care among their tax hiking measures.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
so I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith. This hadith is about the prayer, the salat, the ritual prayer. And specifically, it's about humbleness in prayer, being humble in prayer. It's interesting to note that this subject has been mentioned in the Holy Quran. In the Holy Quran, we read the following in Surah Mu'minun, very famous verse. Certainly the faithful have attained success. قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ. Those who are humble in their prayers. الَّذِينَ هُمْ فِي صَلَاتِهِمْ خَاشِعُونَ. With respect to this, the Holy Prophet said, the prayer of one who does not humble himself in his prayers does not count. Right? So being humble in prayers is very necessary. It's a condition for the fulfillment of this prayer. But this hadith doesn't kind of mention like how we should be humble in prayer. Fortunately, this is something which has been kind of explained in other hadiths. For example, we read the following in this next hadith. In a hadith narrated in the book Da'im al-Islam, a book of hadiths, it says that any time Imam Ali alayhi salam would stand for prayer, he would be like a fixed structure or a straight pillar, not moving at all. And sometimes when he would bow or prostrate, he would be so still that a bird would perch itself on him. Nobody, this hadith nobody was ever able to match the prayer of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam, except Imam Ali alayhi salam, Ali ibn Abi Talib, and Ali ibn al-Husayn, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. Okay? So part of being humble is that a person should be still, should fidget here and there, right? Move around, right? This is kind of a manifestation of this humility in front of God. In another hadith, we read the following. In the book, A'lamuddin, a famous book, it's been narrated that whenever the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, would perform his ablutions, his wudu, the color of his face would change out of fear of Allah. Right? So this is kind of a natural reaction of being humble, in front of God, being fearful for him, of his awesomeness, his greatness. And this leads to kind of, the changing in one's complexion, kind of a physical, change in complexion. This is a manifestation of that humbleness. In another hadith, we read the following. Man should be humble in his prayers, in his salat. For verily, he whose heart is humble before Allah, mighty and exalted, his limbs will humble themselves too, and will not fidget around. Of course, we should like to add the reservation. The moving around a lot in prayer is